Yeah, once again, listeners, we're interviewing Rowan Jacobson and his latest book. I mean, all of his books are stunningly filled with details and research that I could only imagine doing. But this one, there's so much in it that I didn't know about, and I probably should have, so I'm glad I got a chance to read your book. Rowan, it's Wild Chocolate. In fact, I didn't even realize there was such a thing. Across the Americas in Search of Cacao's Soul. It's wondrous in its details, but the way you write, you make it sound like a mystery novel. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, I kind of feel like every book should be a mystery novel in some sense, right? It should always, every chapter should leave you with a question that you want answered so that you want to go on to the next chapter. So, yeah, I agree. Like, I think that's a pretty good framework.
Yeah, well,
whether it's fiction
I
or
think it's true. I mean, I just, so many things I had never, I wasn't actually even clear on the difference between cacao industry and the drug trade.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because they cacao, it's a tropical plant, so it grows in those same areas of Latin America that coca leaf grows, that's used for cocaine,
yeah.
And other drugs are found in that same area. But so the territory kind of overlaps with some of these other, like some of the major controlled substances. So, you know, like if you're growing cacao, if you're involved in the cacao business, you can't help but cross paths with some of these other, you know, illegal businesses, which adds an, you know, a little bit of intrigue to the.
Yeah, well, certainly.
Are we right in generally saying that this sort of an Aztec frame of mind that comes with eating chocolate or drinking chocolate?
Yeah, for sure. The Maya and the Aztec were two of the first cultures to really like popularize it and make it a big part of their like daily life. So yeah, we kind of like when the Spanish arrived, they just took their cues from them, from the Maya and the Aztec.
You know, I'm looking back.
They didn't take it up with the Spaniards.
The Spaniards, you know, they adopted it, but what they was it one thing, interesting thing, the Maya and the Aztec didn't sweeten their chocolate at all. So it was a pretty bitter drink. It was really used more for ritual purposes. And the Spanish thought, well, this is pretty good, but it would be a lot better if we put some sugar in it. So they're the ones who started sweetening it. And then, of course, that was what caught on all over the world was the sweetened version.
Well, you know, I've read a lot and we've interviewed a lot of people about chocolate and its introduction into Europe and so forth and so on. But I don't recall ever having the subject of the wild cacao coming up. And how did you write about your discovery of the wild cacao, and you did that brilliantly. Why don't you tell our listeners when the bug hit you to do this book?
Well, you know, and I was like you. I had no idea there was such a thing as wild chocolate. And then, you know, this back in the 1990s when I sort of developed a taste for dark chocolate, and I was looking for the really good bars of dark chocolate that were starting to appear. Companies were starting to source really high quality beans if they could find them from places in the Americas. And then I came across this one bar that claimed to be made with wild cacao. And I thought, you know, what is that? Cause cacao it's just been farmed for centuries. So that got my interest. So then, and then I found out it was, the cacao was coming from this German guy who had lived in the Amazon for 30 years. And he was finding all this cacao growing wild in the jungle and had sort of worked out a deal with some of the locals who lived there to help him harvest it and process it. And then he was selling it to a Swiss company that was turning it into chocolate. And people, you know, people even in the business didn't, even the industry did not believe that it was wild because they didn't think there was still any such plant, but it turns out there's still quite a bit of cacao down in the Amazon, which is where it originated, still growing wild. So it's a lot of effort to get to it, but if you can,
yeah,
you can get a really amazing experience from it.
You write about the cacao itself. It has a terroir involved, much like wine. What are there major differences between the wild cacao that you were researching in Latin America and the cacao that's grown in, is it Eastern or Western Africa?
Yeah, it's mostly, most of our cacao today, about 70% of it comes from Western Africa, where it's farmed extensively. And yeah, it is quite different. The wild cacao, the beans are smaller, and they're actually less bitter than the chocolate that we're used to. So you can make, you know, like right now the trend is like the percentage, like 60% cacao, 70% cacao. With the wild stuff, you can go 70, 75, and it's still not very bitter at all. And it has these sort of beautiful aromatic qualities. And so this is that original chocolate that the Maya fell in love with. And some of the other indigenous cultures. In industrial, as it got farmed, they ended up choosing varieties that were more productive, so you could farm a lot more of it, but they were more bitter. And that's what we've been stuck with ever since.
Yeah, you didn't, your first taste of it actually in situ, where it's growing, wasn't that complimentary. You had to do stuff to it, right?
Yeah, the tasting it wild.
Yeah, your first taste of the wild cacao.
Yeah, well, so what's interesting is, and you can still find this in those if you're in the small towns in the Amazon, like they might be selling local chocolate, but it isn't necessarily processed very well. Like they don't really have the equipment to do fine chocolate that's you know, European style chocolate making. And they don't, a big part of making really good cacao is how you ferment the beans and then how you roast beans. That's key.
Yeah.
And what happens in the, you know, in the jungle is it gets badly fermented. So it kind of gets an off flavor from that. And then it gets roasted over an open fire. So it gets a very smoky flavor. And that's, you find that in Mexico too. A lot of the chocolate in Mexico is just kind of, it's astringent and tastes a little bit burnt because of the processing. But the material itself is really good.
Now, can't some of my guys from Britain say I had a role in the development of chocolate?
Uh-huh.
Who?
The British, of course. The British are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all of the rest.
Yeah, the British invented British are the ones who industrialized it. Yeah, they came up with the Dutch and the British were the sort of the two groups that figured out how to produce it on a mass scale and sort of turn it into something that could be affordable for everyday people. Before then, you know, the Spanish court kind of tried to keep it to themselves once they started bringing it to Europe, and it was very expensive because it was just it was literally. Still being ground on these stone, little grinding stones that they use in Mesoamerica. But then, yeah, so Fry was the guy in England who sort of came up with the process for making cocoa powder using machines.
Okay,
and
yeah, and then I knew we had some credit there somewhere.
Yeah, you get the credit, or you get the blame, depending on who you're talking to.
That's
producing
like it.
That's also true. They fought each other. I don't know if you read every book that's ever been published about chocolate, but we did interview someone who wrote a book called The Chocolate Wars, WARS.
Yeah, they did. Well,
who was a member of the Cadbury family.
Yeah, right. Cadbury and Fry fought viciously
right.
to control the chocolate thing. And then, of course, later on, M&M, Mars battled with Hershey, and like they all battled each other, continue to.
But the characters in your book are really interesting. I mean, they had to be 75 to 80% adventure seekers. I'd be even going into this. I like the story of the woman who was trying to get someplace, and she got on this bus and was covered in the back of it, was all filled with blood. I thought, my God. I kept trying to picture myself in that situation. And she got on the bus and then rode to wherever she was going to go. Your research was adventurous in the extreme, was it not? I mean, your description of flying around looking for landing places and stuff. I mean, that's extreme research, isn't it?
It was. You definitely had to commit yourself. But what fascinated me were these people who were doing this really crazy thing. At least, you know, it's the craziest idea for a business, because you have to go deep into the rainforest, which is, very challenging and inconvenient, and to try to source these beans. And then you have to try to get them out of the jungle in good shape, where you have no infrastructure. So you're using tiny boats and you're hoping you don't get flooded. And then, you know, or you're hoping you don't run into any criminals. And then, even if it all goes well and you get the beans out of the rainforest in good shape, it's not like you're going to make a fortune. You know, you've got small quantities, so you have to really be doing it for some reason other than commercial reasons. And so
yeah,
that
kind of
fascinated me. Like,
it's so tied to the economics of the industry. You wonder how it became the big renaissance of chocolate, of high-end chocolate in the 90s, for example. I mean, it seemed really unlikely that would happen. You know, most industries.
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, why? Why?
Yeah, because you can, if you know wholesale, you can source a kilo of cacao from Africa for $2. So then, but if you're going to get this, this cacao out of the Amazon, it's going to cost you, $9 a kilo. So who is going to pay $9 when they could pay $2 just because it's more interesting, and more flavorful? Well, it turns out, like, for most of human history, the answer would have been nobody. But that whole sort of, like, gourmet revolution that hit in the 90s and the 2000s, especially.
Why did that happen?
I think people became, less enamored with the industrial food system and really were longing for products that would tie back, that would have character and that would tie back to the land in some way and had, were representative of nature in some way. So, and chocolate ended up being a perfect example. And it's affordable in a sense, right? Like, you can pay a dollar for a Hershey bar, or you can pay $8, $9 for an amazing bar that is made with cacao out of the rainforest. So it's a lot more, but at the end of the day, like, $9 is not, a huge luxury spend.
I read something in the newspaper, it might have been over the weekend, that the Mars company, the M&M Mars company, would mm-hmm. just saddle up to buy a producer of chocolate bars of the kind, not the kind you're interested in, but the kind the population consumes as a whole.
Yeah, that's interesting. They are definitely they're in a tough spot in a way. They're because they are they've sort of been nickel and diming the farmers in Africa for so long that those farms are starting to disappear. So there's been, like, the past year, there's been the biggest shortfall of supply compared to demand ever. There's about 500,000 tons of demand for which there's no supply. So the big producers are really, and so prices are surging even for just the regular industrial cacao. So the big producers are really scrambling to find any supply they can right now. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. The economics, how it ties into culture. If you're reading somebody like you or any of the people that were there looking for the original or the wild chocolate, there's always this kind of spiritual undercurrent of the and ritual undercurrent of chocolate, and yet the big chocolate companies have none of that, absolutely none of it. And my understanding was that chocolate initially was did not take off in Europe when it was introduced, but it gained prestige because it was so expensive. Once they brought down the price of it, and it was open to a wider audience, it lost favor. Is that true?
I think, yeah, it sort of had ups and downs. It lost favor. It was the first source of caffeine that hit the hit Europe, but it only arrived a couple of years before coffee and tea. And as we know, like, you get a little kick from chocolate, but you get a much bigger kick from coffee. So once coffee arrived, you know, all those coffee houses in Europe, you know, like, then chocolate lost out to coffee. Like, coffee was cheaper and it gave you more of a buzz. So it lost out. But yeah, I think you're exactly right on the ritual thing. For the cultures in the Americas, it was always a ritual. It was a way of, it was almost like the Japanese tea ceremony, a way of, you know, focusing and appreciating. And so then that, obviously, when chocolate became industrial, that disappeared. But I think that's the other answer to your question about why people are willing to pay more now. I think they're looking for a little bit of ritual in their their chocolate.
You know, is it also interesting?
Hold on a minute. Let me ask
a
question before I forget. Didn't Mr. Lindt, or Lind, who was European of some kind, didn't he make a significant contribution to the development of chocolate? Or am I thinking the wrong thing?
No, you're right. Rudolf Lindt, yeah, he was the first person who discovered that that you could change the flavor of chocolate in the processing of it by he used what's called a conch, and it was called that because it's like a conch.
That, by the way, is good in your book. Nobody ever gave me such a clear explanation of what conching was about until I read your book. Yeah. Congrats.
Oh, good. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So basically what happens is you take these cacao beans and you grind them up really fine, and they've got a lot of fat in them. So it becomes this liquid, this like oily liquid almost. And then what Lindt discovered is that if you just sort of beat it with these paddles and just roll it back and forth, this liquid mass for a really long time, like sometimes for a few days even, it changes the flavor. It gets rid of some of those harsher notes and those astringent notes, and makes it smooth and round and rich. And so conching became one of the things that defined really good chocolate versus cheap chocolate, is they were willing to, you know, spend 48 hours or 72 hours putting it in these machines.
How did the British government decision to say, no, we'll allow the Gold Coast become independent, how did that affect things?
In the Americas?
Well, no. I mean, in this case, for me, I was living in England at the time, so I didn't care about what Americans ate.
Oh.
you're talking about Africa.
But it did.
The Gold Coast. Oh, the Gold Coast. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right, because, well,
Ghana,
so,
right,
yeah, so,
Ghana,
so,
right
Ghana, so Ghana went, yeah, Ghana was British, and it went independent, and Ivory Coast was French, and it went independent, but Ghana, yeah, once Ghana went independent, they actually, they really, like, banked on cacao as, you know, their money machine, because they had all these young people in the country who were unemployed, and they had a ton of rainforest, and there was, they could tell that demand for cacao was really ramping up. So they started producing a lot of cacao, and they actually became number one in the world out of nowhere. Soon they were producing, I forget, it was more than the rest of the world combined. It was a big success, except then they did wipe out their rainforest to do that. And then Ivory Coast came along and outdid them and surpassed them. So Ghana and Ivory Coast are still number one and number two, and together produce more than 60% of the world's cacao.
This niching kind of thing with certain populations is another really peculiar thing to chocolate. The Quakers in England were the chocolate makers. Around here in Pennsylvania, I've asked, I don't know how many guests on this program, even Greeks, why is it that all the chocolatiers and chocolate shops in Pennsylvania are Greek-owned? Do you have any idea what's the connection between Greece and chocolate?
I don't know. I have no idea. There's certain countries like France and Switzerland and England that have deep ties to chocolate
right.
and Spain. I don't know about Greece. That's interesting.
Yeah, they're all Greek-owned. It's just so strange.
Huh.
But the Greeks don't know either. I've asked, I don't know how many of them. I wanted
funny.
To ask a question of now that it's not unusual to find really high-end chocolate, what's happening at the local farming level in these South American countries? Do they have a whole new market, or what do they think? They disliked people interfering with their industry to start with, according to your book. And then when they got something out of it, then they changed their tune. But now that it's so ubiquitous, what's the effect on the producers in these countries in South America?
Yeah, it's interesting because they definitely, it's always been an export market for them. Mexico has always had an extremely strong culture of chocolate consumption, and Guatemala too, but really South America never did. For them, it was always just an export market. So now that's starting to change. Like in Brazil and Peru, they're kind of like trying to capitalize on it as their own indigenous thing can be a draw, but mostly the market is elsewhere. Like especially, if you want to get top dollar, that's all going to the United States, Europe to a certain extent. But most of the little bean to bar makers who are willing to pay that $9 or $10 a kilo for cacao, they're up here in the U.S. So it's a good
Do you think that that interest, especially in the gourmet types, like what's his name, Askenazy, who runs all the chocolate.
Sean Askenazy.
Do they have a positive or a negative or no effect on the production of cacao in Latin America? And he also deals with Africa.
Yeah, it's definitely positive. These small bean to bar makers, and Sean Askenazy is actually he's one of the gold standards on this. They're very interested. Yeah, and they're super interested in supporting the culture and making sure the farmers can make a decent living. So they're working directly with farmers, and they're like. The farmers are getting more money than they have ever gotten before. Like, I know in some places where, if people used to sell into the Mexican market down there, the prices were very, very low. They would just be selling to local coyotes who were just driving by and buying any crop they had for pennies. So suddenly, connecting with these American gourmet chocolate bar makers, they're being paid a lot more. So that's really good for them. And they're also being encouraged to grow organically and sustainably. It's all, quite positive as long as the market will continue to, to support it. Like there are so many chocolate makers in the U.S. now. My only concern is if, it kind of gets maxed out.
Well, we enjoy interviewing them. They always have an interesting background. It's always in something totally different, like the Wall Street or like Askenazy was a criminal trial lawyer, and but of course he's also doing a lot of stuff with education, like his chocolate university, taking students into these villages. But it just seems like there's so many of them now that it has to be diluting the market. No?
I think that so. I think we're going to see. Well, I mean, it depends what happens with the economy in general, but we may see, a little bit of cannibalization taking place, where the bean to bar makers are the market stops expanding for the really expensive chocolate, and suddenly, the small players start to eat each other.
Yeah, like all my Greek chocolatiers.
Yeah, right. They'll definitely eat each other.
My favorite story is this, we interviewed a woman, an Israeli woman, who went to study chocolate making and chocolatiering in France, and she went around apprenticing with all these top producers and so forth. And she went back to Israel only to discover that there was not much interest in chocolate at all there.
And it's funny because the Jews actually played a really important role in the early days of chocolate. Like, a lot of the first Europeans who were making chocolate were actually Jews who had fled the Inquisition in Spain or had fled France for similar reasons and wound up in the Americas and learned how to make chocolate from the indigenous people and then brought it back to Europe. And so for a long time, it was sort of a Jewish cultural thing of making the chocolate.
Really?
But then the French kicked them out again, and then everybody else started doing it.
The interesting thing is that the chocolatiers in England, the people who make the chocolate were all Quakers.
Quakers, right.
There has to be some
mechanism behind the scenes that creates these kinds of communities of chocolate makers and that kind of thing. And it's happened in other industries, so why not chocolate?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's like, it's such a craft sort of centric occupation. So it kind of gets passed down, like a lineage.
Well, what do you do next now? I mean, are you done with this subject, or are there things that you wanted to find out about wild chocolate that you hadn't found out yet?
One thing that I'm curious about is, we've talked about the ritual nature of chocolate. It's really become like cacao ceremonies have become a big thing in both the U.S. and down in the Americas. So I'm curious to see where that goes. Like, people will gather, the same people doing yoga will gather to do a cacao ceremony, or they'll even do it as part of their yoga retreat. Yeah. And
really?
That's fascinating to me,
Because
it's like just a mild, it's kind of how chocolate is always used, because it just gets you, it's mildly stimulating enough that it sort of raises the temperature of the room a little bit, So I think, I'm curious to see if the cacao ceremonies become even more common in the future.
Well, I mean, I must say, I've always been, I don't have a sweet tooth to start with, and I've never that much into chocolate even. But I was always envious of watching people. There's something that comes over, their eyes glaze over with joy. and when they're eating chocolate, have you noticed that their faces change?
Oh, absolutely. No, it definitely has a drug-like effect on people. There's just something, it gets the endorphins going. But, I don't have a sweet tooth either. And what really won me over was drinking chocolate. When I started drinking, a really nice, rich, bittersweet chocolate, just sweet enough to not be, just sweet enough to make it palatable, then I think I finally started to understand that look that, you know, everybody gets when they eat chocolate.
Well, Rowan Jacobson, listeners, you're going to be amazed at how much you don't know about the wild chocolate until you get this book of that title, Wild Chocolate. And it's the search for cacao's soul. And the soul part of it is, I think, a really major part of the whole euphoria of people ingesting chocolate and setting out rituals with chocolate. And you hit that right on the head, Rowan. What's next on your agenda? What are you researching next?
I've spent a little time in Mexico on mezcal, and I recently did a story about mezcal, the mezcal industry down there.
Mezcal.
Yeah.
Somebody was talking to us about mezcal, and there was, I think it was a book on mezcal.
There have been a couple good ones, yeah.
Yeah, and I contacted somebody, and I never heard anything back. But that's interesting, too. Well, you have lots of fun.
Yeah, that's part of the goal, for sure.
Well, again, I thank you for talking to us, as always, and keep us on your list for the next book, huh?
I absolutely will. It's always a lot of fun talking to you guys.
Yeah, well, you too. Okay, again, much success with this book.
Thank you, thank you. And take care, both of you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
No, something's...
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.